Hey, Freddy's Nation. Welcome to another episode of Never a Dull Moment. Excited to kick off the new year 2025 with a topic that has been widely requested, private equity and how it works for franchisees. Today, we are very fortunate to have a guest with us who has tremendous experience in the restaurant space and with private equity. I believe Jim is now a partner at Capital Spring. Is that right, Jim?
I am.
Well, welcome.
Head up the Strategic Operations Group, which is a fancy phrase for operations.
Perfect. So a little bit of deep finance and coupled with a lot of operations.
Absolutely correct.
Awesome. Well, look, guys, you've requested to learn more about private equity and how it works at the franchisee level. And Jim here has a tremendous amount of experience in that space, and I thought it would be great to bring him on. I actually met you, Jim. I think you at the time were the CEO of Sizzling Platter, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
All right. Well, let's start from the beginning. I think you've been in the restaurant business for a minute. So take me back to how it all started.
Maybe longer than you, Chris. I don't know. We'll see. I started when I was 14, working summers. Worked the dish tank, started an Italian restaurant. I grew up in New York. The restaurant was outside of the city. Yeah, it was, tough experience, super busy, very small place. Husband and wife ran it.
I don't think there's more of a into the frying pan than trying to run restaurant operations in New York City.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It is definitely tough. And these were hardcore Italian cooks. So Everything was undercooked.
Yep.
The chicken, the bone, the joints was red, and so people would constantly be sending the food back. They would get angry and go to the table, which you obviously can't do today.
Right.
And it was a very interesting experience.
That's great. So that you started in the weeds, and then where'd you go from there?
I did. So continued to work in the space, summers, and then, through high school, I was actually also a magician, if you believe that, for little kids' birthday parties.
Well, you kind of have to be a magician to be a CEO in the restaurant business.
That's true. That's probably where I learned most of my talents.
There you go.
Continue to work in the space. And then in college, I started a small catering company, mostly for the concerts that were around town. I'm afraid to say which school it was, given where we're sitting right now. It's a competitor of KU. I'll leave it at that.
All right.
Ran that catering business, started a little organization that was the liaison between the food service at the university and the students, because all the students were complaining about the food.
Sure.
I was like, well, let's have some sort of regular communication. So I started that little committee, graduated, had a stint in the movie business, which did not go well.
Lead actor?
Yeah, that's why it didn't go well. I was the guy doing, the take one, what they call the slates.
Oh, perfect.
It was a lot of waiting and egos. It wasn't for me. Went back into the restaurant business and, fast forward, here I am today.
All right, nice. So when I met you, you were at Sizzling Platter. Tell me a little bit about Sizzling and what you walked into when you took the role there. And I think you just moved on less than a year ago?
A couple months ago. Yeah.
Okay.
Capital Spring bought a controlling interest in Sizzling Platter in 2019.
Okay.
The business experienced some short-term pain. Just to go maybe a step back, Sizzling Platter is a large franchisee platform.
Sure.
So at the time we were in, I think, 6 brands.
Okay.
We had about, a little less than 400 locations in the U.S. and Mexico. And we were in Little Caesars, Wingstop, Dunkin', trying to think, Red Robin, and then Sizzler was the original brand where Sizzling started.
Yeah.
Back in actually the 60s. Anyway, took over. Business didn't do that well. CEO decided to leave. I stepped in 2019 and, ran it through until a few months ago.
Sure.
We'll end this year. We ended 2024 with close to 800 locations.
Yeah, you doubled it.
8 brands. Added Jersey Mike's, added Jamba, added Cinnabon. And, almost quadrupled the EBITDA of the business.
Yeah, that's amazing. So when you came in at Sizzling, were you brought on by Capital Spring?
I mean,
was it before their investment?
Just given my role within operations at Capital Spring, if there's an issue at one of our portfolio companies or
you
a sudden
in.
Departure,
sure.
I'm the Band-Aid.
Okay.
Then COVID hit, so this Band-Aid lasted a little bit longer than normal. Plus, you know, it was having a lot of success. It was a big investment for us. So
right.
We felt like it made sense, but it became increasingly difficult to do both of my roles.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
So
at Sizzling, were y'all focused more on organic growth, or were you looking at strategic acquisition?
I mean, both, okay. Really.
Yeah.
You know, you want a healthy ratio of both. You know, there are businesses out there. I don't want to mention the names of a particular business that's the largest franchisee platform who doesn't do a lot of organic growth. And I think part of the reason is he's so big that it doesn't just move, it really doesn't move the needle for him. But for us, you know, it was important for us to, you know, build new stores in all the brands we were in.
Sure.
But then also acquire within the brands we're in. And you want some ratio of either 3-1 or 4-1, somewhere in there we felt was a healthy ratio. It's always safer to buy.
Sure.
Right?
You know what you got.
Yep. But brands want you to grow.
Right.
And so there's a balancing act. And if you want that hunting license for M&A, you need to build stores.
Right.
And so, you know, it's finding that balance.
Yeah. At Freddy's, when we see transactions within our operating groups, you know, we require the franchisee to commit to some level of new unit development with that. We're not in favor of transfers that are just simple takeout and no growth. So, yeah, I get that.
And it creates opportunity for your team members.
Sure.
Because when you acquire stores, usually it comes with teams.
Right.
But as you build new stores, you know, you can promote assistant managers, general managers, general managers, district managers. So there's ancillary benefits.
Yeah. You know, even here corporately, today we have 36 corporate restaurants, and when Thompson Street came in, they were like, yeah, we don't need to open any more restaurants. And I'm like, actually, we do. we're going to continue to build new restaurants and create opportunities for our team. And at first, you know, traditional private equity guys that didn't have a tremendous amount of restaurant experience coming in were like, yeah, but, you know, we could do other things with the capital. And I'm like, yes, but it's important for us to create those opportunities and continue to build our bench. And, you know, now I think that they're all in favor of it, and they've seen the returns come in nicely. And so, yeah, it's important to continue to build your business, because if you're not growing, well,
right,
you're probably going the other way, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So when you were looking at acquisitions, what were some things that were attractive to you from a, you know, strategic platform position? What was the target?
Yeah, I mean, we started with, you know, across all of our brands, we had a certain level of margin that our business was generating. We mm-hmm. typically didn't want to drop below that margin as a percent, not as a dollar, because then it might bring down the overall business, right?
Yep.
Especially if it was a chunkier acquisition. Strategic is typically a new brand versus we did a lot of tuck-in acquisitions in the brands we were already in.
Mm-hmm.
And even there, we typically try to find at least close to the margins we were generating.
Yep.
We liked at system or above system AUVs, right? You don't
sure.
want to buy businesses again that, unless, you know, there's a clear path to a turnaround where you know that there might be an absentee operator or somebody understaffed their restaurant, you know, with the proper staffing, you'll eventually hit the AUVs system. But, you know, that was a big piece of it. Geography is a big piece, right? If you're not operating in California, the restaurants are in California. Those present different challenges,
sure,
as
indeed.
You probably know,
yeah.
between, you know, some of the meal breaks.
It's a tough place.
Rest breaks, right. So, you know, geography was another thing. And then, you know, you really want to find business that has a similar culture to yours.
Yep.
You know, we've looked at a couple of businesses where, you know, it was really, I believe anyway, more EBITDA driven.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say they were trying to save the way to prosperity,
right.
but it was much more bottom line driven, and that was the culture, and that's fine for some people. It's not the culture that, you know, I was proud of at Sizzling Platter.
Sure.
We were much more people focused and staffed our restaurants properly, and, you know, I always felt EBITDA would come,
yep.
you know, if you made the right investments. And so, you know, we wanted to make sure they had the right culture, so when they folded into your business, it wasn't this big change
right.
and shock for either side. You know, and that was another big piece, big change that I made when we were acquiring businesses before I got there. We would immediately send a team out there and say, this is the Sizzling Platter way, and this is how to do it. And our turnover at the GM level was 240%, because they would just get overwhelmed day
sure.
one. And it wasn't even operating the restaurants. It was how to do payroll our way, how to
right.
do reporting our
way.
It's
a lot of change.
And so I said to our team, I want you to spend the first 90 days and tell me all the things they're doing better than we're doing. So, you know, their perspective shifted immediately, and now we're looking for ways to improve our own business.
Sure.
And we would pick up a lot of nuggets of areas where we can improve.
Sure.
Not to mention the GMs weren't intimidated. They continued to run their business the right way. And then
right.
it gave us time to prioritize, okay, as we take this business over, you know, what's the highest priority changes we need to make, and how do we soft roll yep. those changes so yep. that our GMs aren't overwhelmed, because it's such a key position in the business.
I love that. You know, when I see acquisition here at Freddy's and in other brands that I've been associated with, it's like you go too fast, that's a problem. If you're quick to move people on before you've really given them a chance to show you what they got, that can be problematic. And if you go too slow, that too can be problematic. And I love that you guys went into it with a mindset of, you know, there might be a better way. As a, you know, as an acquirer of brands in my past life, I was always very keen to, hey, let's see if we can learn something here. So kudos for checking the ego and being willing to look at different ways of doing things.
Yeah, we don't know what we don't know.
That's right.
You know, and we're all students of the industry.
Yeah. And when you talk about people, you know, I think some of our Z's who have contemplated a transaction to a strategic acquirer, I think they fear that their whole team's in jeopardy. You know, they hear strategic and they think they're just going to wipe the whole thing out. And the Freddy system is a very much a familial company. The culture is really built around family and having great people and treating them well. And our Z's want to know that people are going to be treated well. And so, you know, maybe if you could just expand on how you evaluate talent and how important it is for you that you acquire not only a business, but people that are good and qualified.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, we all say it all the time, you know, people make the business.
Right.
I believe in the flywheel of, you know, you invest in your people, they stay longer. If they stay longer, they execute better against the guest. If they execute better against the guest comes more often, you do more business, you can invest in your people. And it creates that flywheel.
Amen.
And so the same thing applies with, you know, when you're doing acquisitions. Like I said, the first thing, you know, you spend some period of time, and it depends on the business. You know, if it's a business brand you're already in, it may take yep. less time than a new brand.
Sure.
But, you know, you're evaluating the people, making sure that, you know, your culture, again, that they're not completely adverse to what your culture is.
Right.
And you spend that time really looking at in the restaurants, in the field, understanding how they execute, who they are, what they stand for. And, you know, even if there are differences, if they've been programmed in a certain way, you know, let's say they were programmed to, you know, run the tightest staff and, you know, have no food waste and really try to operate for bottom line EBITDA. You know, to some degree, we're all in the EBITDA business.
Of course.
But there's a balance. You know, then sometimes it just takes some training and yeah. saying, this is how we do things.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe they're the other way, where they're over-investing in talent and they're over-investing in hours, and maybe there is some fat there, you know, especially in the shoulder periods. And you say, hey, you know, do we really need 8 people working when it's, you know, 2 to 4 p.m.
Sure.
and our business is much lower?
So. Sure. Have you seen, when you were at Sizzling, did you have folks that came through acquisition that advanced through the company that were able to glean some opportunity with the new ownership?
Absolutely. You know, we were very proud of that. In fact, one of the brand presidents, and for the different brands, one thing that I did is, you know, I basically had almost like mini CEOs of their business, and they were assigned a finance person who was quasi-CFO because they were running, you know, a platform,
right?
Of, you know, several restaurants. Our smallest was almost 30.
Okay.
So, you know, and our biggest was 450.
Wow. It's a monster.
Yeah. It was, you know, big, big business. But, you know, we had, I mean, there was a girl that came with our Jamba business who was a district manager who's now in our real estate department, and she's directing site selection.
I love that.
You know, we've had, you know, a gentleman who came over from another brand. He became a brand president of one of our other brands.
Yep.
You know, there's some great talent out there, and, you know, sometimes you don't know what you have, and, you know, you acquire this business
yep.
and you start working with the person and they rise to the occasion, and, you know, you meet as a leadership team, as you know, Chris,
sure.
and you say, we need to watch this person and see what happens,
right.
and you know, make sure they don't leave.
Yes,
you know, and hopefully they get promoted.
Yes,
you know, it's exciting for.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about, you know, being a franchisor and having a system that's at scale, because, you know, it gives us the opportunity to really let people find their way. You know, they may come in as a, you know, hotline employee, and years later end up as, you know, a director of real estate or in communications or IT, and they're a good person, they're smart and they're talented, and we're able to you know, build on that and create opportunity. And that's, you know, I love here at Freddy's, we have a lot of tenure in our corporate office, and we have folks who have come through restaurant and are now doing, you know, bigger things and helping to drive the strategy of the business. And so it's just exciting. It's exciting to have a business that allows you to do that. You know, and in a lot of places, folks can get stuck in a cubicle, but in the restaurant business, if there's a will, there's typically a way. So I love that.
It's one of the most fulfilling parts of our business, yes, really, is to see people excel. You know, there's not a lot of other businesses out there, by the way, where it doesn't matter if you're a high school graduate, a college graduate, we pay you to train.
Right.
So you don't have to learn.
Right.
We pay you to learn.
That's right.
And you know, there's some incredible people out there that, you know, you find these gems, and it's just incredible to see them grow within your organization.
For sure.
We had a lady who retired right before Christmas, who was with us for 46 years.
Wow.
That was our longest tenured employee. I don't know what employee number she was, but I think she was in the single digits.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing.
That's great. I love that. All right. So, you know, shifting gears a little bit, you know, I know that Capital Spring, as a PE firm, is making acquisitions of brands and groups along the way, and probably a little different set of criteria than Sizzling Platter, who was an operating platform. For, you know, we have groups of franchisees that are, you know, it's pretty meaningful size that have questioned, you know, is there a right time to entertain private equity, or is private equity a good move? And so talk to us a little bit about what are you guys looking at when you're thinking about buying a platform?
The Capital Spring level.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking for, you know, similar to Sizzling Platter, right? We want to buy good businesses,
yep,
that have good trends, that are performing well, right, at the end of the day.
Sure.
You know, and there's some PE firms that are different. We don't buy turnarounds, and we don't invest in turnarounds. We only...
Yeah, on that point, will you look at a brand that has an operating group that is strong, and maybe there are some groups that are weaker, that there's a, you know, potential roll-up opportunity? Is that attractive, or are you more focused on a healthy organization that's really not looking to take on something that needs love and nourishment?
I mean, if it's within the same brand,
yep,
if it's a Freddy Z and they're looking at another Freddy Z that they know that if they put in, again, let's say there's an absentee owner,
yep,
or something happened in the person's life and,
sure,
they haven't been able to operate the restaurants, they're, you know, optimize it to their full capacity, we're definitely interested in those types of investments.
Sure.
So it would, in that situation, it would be a turnaround that we might invest in, where we're saying, okay, we're going to invest in this one business, we're going to acquire this other business, they're going to apply their best practices, and then ultimately this business we expect it to achieve and hit similar metrics.
Yep.
You know, provided the locations are good.
Right.
Some extenuating circumstances.
Of course.
Prevent turnarounds from really reaching their full potential. But so, you know, we look for strong businesses. We look for good management teams. You know, we're not in the business, despite the fact that I took over Sizzling Platter. It's not,
right,
our model, because
it's not what you want to be doing.
I can't be running,
that's, yeah,
you know, 1,000 restaurant companies. So we like strong teams that we can support. You know, we bring to the table something I think that's a little bit unique. A lot of PE firms can write a check and they can provide some strategic support, you know, quarterly at the board level.
Yep.
I've really tried to bring other resources to the table. So we have deals with ADP and other kind of, you know, sort of on the periphery vendors and technology platforms and,
sure,
other things that we've negotiated leveraging our scale.
That's awesome.
That they can plug into. We don't require anybody. If you have a better payroll system,
right,
go use that. Or if you have a better this, go use that. But, you know, at least we can provide it and some leverage our scale a little bit. Again, we like to invest in great teams where we can really pour the gas on the fire and help them grow.
Sure.
And that growth, like you said earlier, Chris, comes in the form of new stores and hopefully some acquisitions.
Yeah, that's great. And when you think about size of an organization, you know, is there a low bar of EBITDA that is important for you guys before you can get excited about something?
Yeah, so we're investing out of two funds. One of our funds is can invest in smaller businesses, so you know, can go down to a couple of million of EBITDA, and they're writing smaller checks. And then we have our flagship fund, you know, where we're writing checks really not below the $25 million level.
Sure.
We can invest out of each. There's no difference, you know, to the end franchisee that we're investing in. From their perspective, it's capital spring.
Right.
So it really doesn't matter. So for us, you know, on the low end, I would say $2 million of EBITDA, and there really is no high end.
That's great. So, you know, as you think about, I know this is a tricky question, but, you know, when you think about multiple and how you guys get to a multiple that you can afford to pay for a brand, what are some things that are important to our franchise groups to be thinking about if they're considering that type of transaction?
Yeah.
to try to get their highest and best multiple?
Sure. You know, it's if you know, and you may get to this question later, but you know, what does private equity kind of look for, and how you should prepare yourself for it? But you know, from the multiple standpoint, you know, there are certain things you can do to enhance your multiple. You know, as we look at a business, right, the multiples of EBITDA, and that EBITDA is corporate EBITDA, so it's after some form of back office G&A support,
sure,
right, and that can vary from business to business depending upon the size. Smaller businesses tend not to be able to leverage the G&A as well, right? You have certain finance people and leadership people that the more units you have, you can leverage those positions more efficiently. But we look at that corporate EBITDA number. In some cases, if that corporate back office support is a little bit kind of wonky, we may apply a number and say, you know, this is what we think the G&As would cost in a normalized situation.
Right.
So you want to maximize that EBITDA at the end of the day. That's going to drive the multiple, right, without sacrificing the execution against the guest. You know, driving EBITDA, it's important that you're in good standing with the brand.
Right.
You know, we don't want violations.
Sure.
You know, whether it's remodel violations, any remodel that you have that's near term is probably going to be deducted from the purchase price because
right.
it's a cash
yeah,
expense
you, gotta,
you know
you
is coming up.
You got to turn around and do the work.
Right. And then, you know, we look at white space. It's very important to us, right? Because if you can grow, you know, and you pay X multiple, that multiple can come down
right.
if you're growing, provided that the return on that growth is 20% or better,
right.
you can grow down that multiple. And so white space is pretty important as well. You want to make sure your lease terms are sufficient, that you don't have very good units that have leases that are expiring in 2 years, because it's
right.
hard for us to value that part of the business.
Yes.
So there's some things you can do to help move that multiple up. But, you know, that multiple varies a lot depending upon the size of the business. Like
right.
I said, you know, how much white space might be there, where that white space is. Is it infill? Is it kind of newer markets? You know, is it going to cannibalize some of the stores you're in? There's just a lot of factors that come into play when you're thinking about that multiple.
Kind of a off-the-wall question, but have you seen where maybe one or two operating groups in the system have come together and partnered to try to bring in an equity partner, and that had ended in success or failure? Do you have any experience there?
We've seen that a few separate times. I would say more often successfully than
Great.
Failure. It's really just about coming together and saying, okay, we're going to agree that if it sells north of that price, we're both going to sell.
Sure.
And you know, making sure that those terms are very crisp.
Yeah, alignment.
So that, yeah, exactly. So that when it comes to fruition, you know, there's no, well, you know, you're taking that off. I'm not taking that off,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
Because as long as you're in the same brand at the end of the day, you know, the ownership groups, as long as, you know, again, the G&A, they might be a little bit different on a per store basis.
Right.
You kind of have to figure that out. But,
sure.
Yeah, we've seen it. We've seen it be successful.
That's great. So how do you guys think about real estate? A lot of our franchisees buy dirt, build restaurants, own it, and some will carry those for long periods of time. Some will look to do a sale leaseback, you know, shortly after construction. But, you know, we do have groups out there that are, you know, talking about the possibilities of private equity, and they're sitting on, you know, a number of units that they own completely. Do you guys like to acquire real estate in your transactions, or are you looking to separate those?
You know, typically we go asset light.
Sure.
And so most PE firms are going to prefer a leased portfolio. And so there's two ways to approach it. One is, hey, seller, you keep the real estate.
Right.
And as long as the rent is market and, you know.
Set a lease and
go on with it. Alternatively, hey, we'll buy that real estate from you. We'll probably sell lease back it. You know, from a PE perspective, as said, you know, we're very asset light. And a lot of times we see sellers, you know, and if they're not interested in selling to PE, holding that real estate may make sense to them based on their investment philosophy.
Sure.
But for PE, typically we prefer the lease model.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When you are building new restaurants, what's the style of investment you guys like to make? Do y'all do, you know, buy, build, sell, lease back, or do you like to do, you know, full build to suit? Kind of what's y'all standard MO if you have one?
I mean, we really look at it from a return standpoint.
Sure.
So, you know, it comes in all shapes and sizes and forms. You know, ground lease is not something that we
typically don't love.
We don't like ground leases, but, you know, anything else, really, it's just about being opportunistic and what the terms are. And again, you know, you want to be north of that 20% return. And so as long as it yields the right return, you know, it can come in any form.
Nice. So if I'm out there, I've got a, you know, decent business that I'm, you know, maybe I've owned it for 20 years or 10 years and I'm thinking that this is the time. How do I go about marketing my business to private equity if that's the route that I think I want to take?
I mean, I think first, you know, I'd probably sit down and kind of prepare for that before you go and market it. And so some of the things to think about, like I said, you know, you want to look at how you compare to other operators in the brand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times you can call up other franchisees and say, hey, what are you running? What am I running? Because most likely PE is going to do the same thing. And you want to make sure you're not way below everybody else because, again, that could hit you on value. You know, we look at things like, are the restaurants properly staffed? Make sure that, you know, you're not kind of driving that EBITDA for short-term value and neglecting repairs and maintenance.
Long-term damage.
Right. It does long-term damage, even though you think it may drive EBITDA in the short term. We see those things typically because you see so many deals.
Yeah.
We peel that onion back.
It's pretty hard quickly, I imagine.
To hide stuff from us. We look at turnover. You know, that's an important statistic for us. We look at, again, remodels. We look at what the cost of the recent builds. So you want to sort of be able to kind of tell a story and have a set of data going into it. You know, there's some other legal things. S-corps are harder for PE firms to buy because we have different classes of equity.
Right.
You can have different classes of equity in S-corps. So we prefer LLCs.
Right.
So there are some other little changes
nuances
you might have to make between, you know, that you may want to talk to an accountant or a tax advisor about. You know, another thing is you want to think a lot of PE firms like sellers to roll some of the equity that they're selling into the business.
Sure.
And so if
you want to know they believe, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
And also, you know, you're buying a business that's successful. This, you know, group of people is a part of it. And
right.
if they all want to leave, you know, that could put the business at risk.
It's a little scary.
Yeah. So, you know, there may be board roles you want them to participate in, site selection. I mean, who knows, you know, what their talents are that you may want to keep them for. So I'd be thinking, too, do I want to exit 100% because you need to be very honest? Or, you know, do I want to roll 20% into the next transaction?
Sure.
You know, what that percent that you're comfortable with, what your role is going to be, how much effort do you want to put in, thinking about those things ahead of time.
And if you're thinking you want to phase out, that's a great time to talk about a plan of how you come in day one with a, you know, day, you know, 365 exit.
Right. Yeah, you know, it may be a two-year, hey, I'll be involved for 2 years and I'll do these, you know, perform these functions
right.
and support you and help transition to new people. But, you know, 2 years, you know, I prefer to be out.
Sure.
You know, and you just, you know, you also want to make sure that, you know, if there's a story, for example, store closures or there was a big lawsuit that happened or something
right.
that you're able to explain through any historical issues and make sure to be as transparent as possible.
Yeah.
You know, any relationship, it's not just private equity.
Sure. Surprises aren't really welcomed in business.
Right.
Unless they're just really good surprises. How do you think about bankers? Do you think it's important for franchise groups to go out and, you know, get a banker to get in there and build a book and run out to the market? Or do you think you can do it organically and have success?
You know, I have a lot of friends that are bankers.
Yep.
So the short answer is...
They probably won't hear this podcast, so you're safe.
Okay, that's good.
There you go.
Then I'll be honest. I'm just kidding. bankers can play a very good role, right? And most sellers believe that unless I go to a banker and go to an auction process, I'm not going to get the highest value.
Right.
That's not always true. A lot of times, you know, and keep in mind, all due respect to the bankers.
Sure.
You know, think about a real estate broker that's really wants a listing for your house and may say, you know, I think your house is worth $1 million when it's really only worth $800,000.
Sure.
So they get the listing and they list it for $1 million. It doesn't sell. And then you lower it and it sells for $800, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, keep in mind that, you know, bankers tend to, I don't want to say divide by two when they give you a price, but, you know, there should be a discount rate applied because typically they're not selling as, you know, sometimes they do, but
sure.
Sometimes they don't. So, you know, I'd be thinking about, you know, where the banker's guiding you to value. And it's a lot of work to put a book together. You're obviously going to pay a fee to a banker. So to the extent that you know somebody that might be interested and you can reach out and say, you know, here's my financial information, not put your team through, you know, an inordinate amount of work and get to a price that's very close, sometimes that's a lot more preferable than going through the process.
Sure.
Because, you know, that process is, you know, you're providing all this information to the banker a lot more oftentimes than you're actually providing to, you know, maybe
sure.
a seller, a PE buyer. And then you're doing management meetings,
right,
which are tedious, you know, and then you're doing tours. Right. And if you don't want to tell your team members that you're selling the business, yeah, why are these people
gets
touring?
A little tricky. Now you have to be maybe dishonest.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Which we don't want.
That's not our culture.
So exactly. So, you know, there's benefits to both. I would say if you know groups that are interested, go to them first.
Sure.
See if it's getting within range and then you can make the judgment. Okay. Is it worth getting another half turn and
right.
going through that process? Or maybe I won't get it and I go through all that work and.
Yep, that's great advice. One last question on private equity and you know, how you think about things. Our franchisees that have expressed some interest in that route have always questioned me about hold period and what to expect. And, you know, am I going to get in with a group who's going to want to hold this for 15 years? And if I roll, am I going to be sitting on that? And maybe if you can just walk us through, you know, how long do you guys think about holding a business and, you know, are there times along the way, if you hold it longer, that there's opportunities for people to cash in their chips and move on?
You know, our hold period's a little bit longer, mainly because we invest almost 95% in restaurants.
Sure.
And so restaurants take longer
right.
than if you're buying like a manufacturing plant that you can turn on
sure.
productivity tomorrow, right? It's just...
You got to build the plant.
Exactly. I mean, this is so, you know, it takes time to have guests come back, you know, based on their visits.
Sure.
It's just a different business model. So, you know, our hold periods are a little bit longer. Typical private equity holds are 5 years. You know, ours are 7, sometimes longer. Because our next fund's going to be restaurants, we actually have moved investments from fund to fund. We've held things for as long as 15 years because they're great investments. We know they're going to continue to be great investments.
Sure.
And if we don't put them in the new fund, we have to find another investment we don't know and put that in the new funds. So we might as well take this from fund,
sure.
one fund to another. But I think it's part of, like, as you think about PE firms and who you're going to choose, remember, you know, it's a marriage to a great degree. I mean, you're tied at the hip for some period of time.
Sure.
And you have to work together on something that's very dear to you, you know, if you are going to continue working in the business. So, you know, make sure to pick the right partner who has a good reputation. Talk through that hold period because a lot of times that hold period is tied to the growth. And, you know, some private equity firms like a very sharp growth profile and some like, you know, we tend to be a little bit more disciplined. I'd rather have a great site than just open units for the sake of opening them. And so, you know, we tend to be a little bit more disciplined in that growth.
Right.
And that's why our hold times are a little bit longer.
No, that's great. So I lied to you. I actually have one more question. You know, I've heard franchisees say, you know, what scares me about private equity is that now I'm going to have a boss. So let's say you're selling and you're still interested in being a part of the company and the private equity firm is excited to have you as an operating partner. What does governance look like under private equity versus, you know, I'm my own guy? Is it intrusive or is it something that people can manage?
That's a big question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the end of the day, as I said, this is part of that marriage, right? Yep. You want to make sure you're with the right partnership and that your interests are aligned.
Sure.
And so, you know, what I would say is, look, you can always sell a minority of your business so that you're the boss.
Sure.
And, you know, we've done the last couple of transactions have actually been minority transactions for us where, you know, we're investing and we don't own 51% or more of the business. And so, you know, we're there to support, you know, the management team that's in place, right? So putting that aside, because that's one way to continue to be the boss and bring in private equity, right? But if you are selling majority of the business, again, and staying involved in some capacity, you're continuing to run it, let's say, and, you know, you've taken chips off the table and put some cash on the balance sheet for an acquisition or growth or whatever it may be.
Sure.
They're going to have controlling board. You'll probably have a board seat or a board observer position, depending upon your stake in the business.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you know, for us, again, we're investing in the management team. If they're staying and running the business at the end of the day, you know, we want to invest in them. And so we will look and say, hey, how can we support? You know, so an example is, as you pick a site, we have site memos that go through and they, you know, we do deep dives on correlations. You know, the sites that do really well have these positive correlations to household income or demographics. So we can bring some analytics to the table. One thing I will say about PE, it's not short of analytics.
Well, yeah.
They're the modeling.
I know that all too well.
Yeah, I'm sure. The reporting is like bananas. But, you know, so sometimes some of that, you know, support, you know, is not necessarily having a boss, but they're bringing something to the table to help you perform your job function better. But at the end of the day, if you're selling a majority stake in the business, you're going to have a boss.
Sure.
And, you know, the key is, you know, we approach it in a very collaborative way because at the end of the day, we're working together towards a common goal. If we're not aligned, then what the hell are we doing here?
Right.
Right. So, you know, hopefully you're not in a position where despite having a boss, you're fighting with them or they're telling you to do something you don't want to do. It's a much more collaborative align going in. You know, we always have a meeting right after closing the transaction where we all sit in a room and we lay out a 3-year plan.
Sure.
And we get aligned together. It's very collaborative. We're not telling you what the 3-year plan is. We actually would rather you tell us.
Right.
And then let's figure it out, sit down, kind of set it and see where it goes.
Tweak it a bit here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. All right. Two last questions. The first industry, as you look at the restaurant industry in 2025, it's a new year. It's been a really cold new year thus far with lots of snow and ice, but when you think about the landscape, you know, how do you feel about what's coming in 25 for us folks trying to feed Americans every day?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some cautious optimism coming out of 24.
Sure.
You know, I think it was a difficult end to the year probably for a lot of folks. It seems like one of the few segments that perform well is actually fine dining, strangely.
Yep. I know.
You know, and it wasn't just seasonal.
Sure.
It just seemed that people with money spent it.
Yep.
But, you know, in the fast and quick serve space, you know, I think I'm cautiously optimistic. I think we're going to see a couple of percentage points of inflation. I think, you know, one plus in COGS, probably one plus in labor. So there may be a little bit of price or some efficiency, depending upon how you offset those costs.
Sure.
But, you know, I think we're going to see, you know, some positive comps. It looks like, you know, on the labor legislation front, there'll be some easing, you know, which could make lives easier for us as operators. So, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Good. I like that. I think I'm in the same camp. So alignment. And one last question. Now I'm really going to put you on the spot. So, you know, you've been around the industry and you've seen a lot of brands come and some go, I assume. But when you look at Freddy's, you know, how are we doing? You know, what do you think about our brand and how we stack up?
I mean, I think a great example is the tour we just did right behind you where you've set up, you know, a kitchen that is really taking advantage of a lot of technology. And I think that, you know, you guys are playing in a special space because you make your food to order. You take a lot of pride in your guest experience and your service and your deliverable. It's not just like getting it out as quickly as possible. Sure, you want to maximize speed and, you know, using the clamshell ovens and some other technology help with that at the end of the day. But, you know, it's a greater focus, I think, on the experience than we see in other brands. And I think brands that are doing that, I think they're going to excel. And I think there's a higher standard that the guest expects now.
Sure.
And if you're not delivering on that standard, you know, you're going to have to discount like crazy.
Right.
And that's the alternative to drive traffic.
Sure.
Where, you know, I think some of the things you're doing around speed and order accuracy, you know, order accuracy being the number one complaint in our business.
Absolutely.
I think it's going to pay dividends.
That's great. You like our food?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
We weren't going to let you out of here if you didn't answer yes to that. Take a lot of pride in our food. It's quite delicious. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on today. I think that our franchise community will really love to hear your advice and your insights. And so, Jim, thank you very much. And I hope nothing but a wonderful and prosperous 2025.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me, Chris.
You bet.
Thanks for listening. If you have any topics you'd like us to consider, please email your ideas to JillT@FreddysUSA.com. That's JILLT@FreddysUSA.com.